So, I want to talk about the idea of a debugger that knows anything. What if you had a debugger and you could ask it any question you wanted to and it would give you the answer? The question, what's my bug, is a little bit too esoteric. Because how do you even define a bug sometimes? But the question, what did X used to be, that's totally legit. And we can define what X used to be. And that is the entire idea of omniscient debugging. The idea that the debugger knows everything. And are you going to talk to me? Yes. So, I would like to begin by proposing that this is an interesting idea. I claim that debugging is easier if you can go backwards in time. But we'll look at that in a moment. It certainly eliminates the worst problems with breakpoint debuggers. Because how many times have you been debugging a program, you set a breakpoint, and you say continue, you've been debugging a program, now it's still good, continue, the data's good, continue, boom, oh my god, it's too late, I missed the bug. Have we done that before?
Yeah.
If you can go backwards in time, that can't happen. Because you can just say, well, step backwards and see what was there. There's no guessing where to put breakpoints. You don't have to put breakpoints. You just go and look at the data you want to look at. There are no extra steps. You don't have to start, examine, continue, start, examine, continue. Just run the program and go back and look at it. No non-deterministic problems. If a problem occurred, you have it. You can just go back and look at it. And it gives a program a unique view of the program. We'll take a look at that in a moment. And the data is also serializable. Meaning that it is possible simply to also run a debugging session and ship it off to a developer. You could have users session and ship it off, started the debugger, ran the program, got to the point where the bug happened. They could save that and ship it off to a developer. They don't need the source code. They don't need to know what they're doing. They can simply capture a run, and we can take a look at it. So, those are the reasons I claim it is interesting. It's not hard to do. All we have to do is record all state changes during the runner program, and we will be able to recreate the state of the computation at any point.
Recreate
whatsoever.
The state.
This is easy.
Recreate so the what state I do, I record all changes to local variables, instance variables, static variables, array elements, the obvious stuff. We also record all method calls, constructors, super methods, etc. So we're basically recording everything.
No surprise. Now, when you are able to step backwards in time, your way of viewing bugs fundamentally changes. And bug is no longer the best description of the situation. It's more like snake grass. You see, if there is a snake hiding in the grass somewhere, and you can find the snake's tail, all you have to do is pull on the snake, and you'll get to the head. And that's exactly what happens in omniscient debugging. You look for the snake's tail, which is a null pointer exception, a data value that printed out wrong, whatever the bug is that you recognize, you start there, and you simply look at the program, and you say, why did this throw a null pointer exception?
And you simply look at the program.
Because X was null. Why was X null? Well, X was null because this guy over here set X to null. So you can just step back and do the obvious thing, and many bugs which are very, very hard to find going forward are absolutely trivial going backwards. Things that will take you hours
forward,
and hours you can
okay.
do going. Now, not all bugs are this type of a bug. In other words, if a program simply fails to output expected data, then we can't see the tail, because instead of putting something out, it simply failed to do anything. Different situation. But we have to know the program, of course, because we had expectations about what the program should do. Because we have expectations, then we have the ability to do a more simple, forward-looking approach and go forward where we expected things to happen. So what we want to do is a large search over a complex data space, and this has already been done. So we don't need me to redo what has already been done. So one of the folks groups that I work with in France did what they call the prologue style event search interspace. And all they're doing is saying, let's make a prologue logical statement, and any data point that matches that, we will pop up. So we can do what they call Mireille Ducasse. I got to spend 6 months in France working on my Frenchie and doing this, so it's great. So basically you can say, we are looking for a method call whose argument 0 is 0 and whose method name is sort.
And we can simply look at all of those. Boom, we can get to the point where the sort method was called with the argument zero. We will take a look at doing that in a moment.
Now, with breakpoint debuggers, I really
don't have to tell you what breakpoint debuggers are like. It's more like a snake,
more like a lizard in the grass, not a snake in the grass. Because when there is a lizard in the grass,
grab the lizard's tail,
what happens to the lizard? He drops his tail, he runs away, and you're left with a lizard's tail. So let's go ahead now and take a look at what the debugger actually looks like. I have the concept of omniscience debugging, and an implementation of it in Java is what I call the ODB. It works like this. It takes the Java bytecodes, instruments the class's bytecode, as you load, very simple to do, runs in the same process as the target program itself, and uses a single lock, which means that if you have multiple threads, you're going to guarantee that all events are linearly ordered, which is not a problem. We can do the same thing in other languages, it's just harder. I'm more concerned with proving that this is interesting to do than I am with doing lots and lots of practical things. So right now I'm trying to get the idea across that this is a really cool thing and that people should be backing and giving me lots of money. Let's take a look. I'm going to use these print strings so you will be recognizing them. If you have an object type, my object, I'm going to assign a number to it. So when you see an object pop up in the debugger, you'll say, ah, oh, that's my object 123. And you have an optional instance variable
optional,
which you can print
out
along
with. Optional.
So that's how the instance variable will be
recognizing
instance variable. Arrays optional. Will look like this. An array of 20 integers, the second array that we've seen. There is the class object, my object. Strings, numbers, characters, booleans, all look like they usually print out. And when we have gone backwards in time, we'll occasionally show something that doesn't even exist yet, and we'll just see double dashes. When I display these things, it's very useful, of course, to open up objects and look at them. So here is a person object by the name of Louis, and you will be able to open and close this. So you can say, ah, his name, he's 23, his address is that object, he's a good friend with Tarby. And you can open up arrays of integers, you see a bunch of integers. You can go backwards in time before this object was created, and at that point it will display like this. And you'll just say, oh, okay, that object hasn't been created yet. And finally, method traces. I make a lot of use of method traces. I find them the most effective way to understand what a program is doing. And the standard method trace in a thread will look like this. We're going to call the frog method of object 1 on object 6, and 156, and a string, and it will return true. So we have done this call. Frog called a twiddle, which called spin 1, 2, 3 times. They all return void, twiddle returned 5, frog, of course, returned true. And what happens is I record this information as it runs, and when we get to the end, I have to take this data and pass it back into there. So, no surprises. So, let's take a tour. Let's see, how are we on visibility? Can we read this? Let's see how we're going to do this. Okay. We will take a few. Let's take a look at some of the basics here. We have a large font and see where we go from there. So here is the method traces, exactly what we looked at before. Is this legible now? Okay. And there's nothing too exciting here. Gee whiz, we started off in main called println, we made a new vector, we called a bad method, a worst method, the worst possible method, we threw a null pointer exception, and of course we caught the null pointer exception in a catch, and you can see there is the classic view of what an exception looks like. You build a stack, and then you pop all the way up. And then, of course, we called a few new things, and we're starting some threads in here, which we'll take a look at in a moment. Makes sense? Our threads are over here. We can actually take a look at all the threads that existed in this program. So we have a bunch of threads. They were named main, primordial, sorter, 1, 2, etc. So there are all the threads, and as we move around in time, we'll be in different threads throughout the moment. We are in the main thread, and of course we are in the first thread, and of course the thread. And down below, we have a fairly standard-looking code window.
And of course, here we are. We're in MAME. We're at the first line. We're going to start working. And there's the other step that we're going to see in just a moment. And finally, the TTY output. We haven't yet output anything, so you will notice double dashes indicating this hasn't happened yet. This is all sitting in the future. We are going to be printing this out. We get to see all of our local variables. So right now we have only one local variable, and pretty soon we'll be putting in values for those other guys. And the this object sits down here because we are in the static main method of demo. We of course see that the this object is actually I put in the class object here. So no big surprises. And let's go back up here. If I want to step through some code, I can use standard debugging lines. Okay, there is the classic step over. I'm going to step to the next line in this method, and there we can see we're stepping through. No surprise there. And of course, you can see everything on the screen updates to whatever the currently selected timestamp is. There's actually a number up here. We're at event number 19 at the moment. So
each statement is an event, right?
So what?
Each statement is an event.
So each thing that I record is an event.
Right.
And for the most part, that number is absolutely meaningless. I never like that. And it's occasionally vaguely interesting. So here is what we're seeing so far. Let's go down and take a look at we're going to make a new demo object right here. I need to drop you down. As I select the thing that I just created. Down. Hello, are we talking? There we go. You will notice over here, the object in question now pops up. So this is just a little window where I can store things that I want to look at. I want to look at the demo zero object, which at the moment looks pretty uninteresting. I can come over here, however, select that object and say, show me the next times any instance variable changed. So the next instance variable changed was, C got set to the character X, which is 88. The next time this changed, B got set to the character equals. And gee willikers, look at that. B is also a character, and we're doing the number thing. So there we are, we're setting the values. And there is our array of 20 integers. If I double click on this, I get to see all of my beautiful integers, gee willikers, they're all zero. Let me close the demo object. Open up, please. I wanted to put the array up on top. So I get to now look at the array. And same thing happens. Show me the next value change in the array. So I can simply come through here and look at the array as it changes. If we look over here, we will notice that we are in a little loop and we're just filling in array data array right here. And so as I click through, I'm filling up the data with relatively random data. So a bunch of numbers. This is a multi-threaded quicksort program we're looking at. So at the end, this array had better be sorted. We can just have fun and go clicking through it, and we will watch the standard quicksort behavior. Let's see, how can I make you guys all fit? So here we are in the sort routine. And the sort routine for quicksort is, of course, the thing that we've all seen 100 times. It has the usual termination conditions. Are we done yet? We're going to then get the average of all the elements in our subarray. And then in a moment, we're going to come down and do the, there we go, we're going to do the whole pivot and exchange. So here is our entire pivot and exchange routine. So what we expect to see is if we come into sort here, let's go ahead and do this right in line. We just are looking at the first line, so let's take a look at what happens next. Well, nothing happened here, so we're going to call average. We can do a step in. So now we're going to look at the routine for average. And of course, average does exactly what you expect it should do, which if we look over at the local variables, we should be watching. There we go. We will watch, sum and I are going to be changing. And so as we step through, and of course, no surprises there. And of course, you can step backwards. We can watch everything get smaller. So all the things that you should be expecting. Please.
If you step backwards and then you step forwards again, is it re-executing when you step forwards? Or is it just replaying the history?
So when I ran the program, I recorded all state changes for the entire run. So all I'm doing right now is just going back and say, at time number 19, just look up the value of everything that you want to display.
So can you set back, change something, and then let it run forward?
Well, actually, you can. Now, is that a useful thing to do? That's a different question.
I mean, often, I mean, I've always wished to be able to step backwards at times when I thought, well, if I go back, if I just, you know, it's taken 15 minutes to get to this point, if I go back and change that one value, and then it should work.
Yep. We'll take a look at that in a moment. Let's do the rest of the tour so that we know what we're working with here. Why don't you down and come over, darling? You guys talk to your computers when you do this?
Yes, I do, but I use like a big tech. All day.
I'm not using words, I'm not
using. I'll do that as well.
So let's go down and take a look at our fine little quick sort routine. We looked through this puppy. What do we want to take a look at now? Right now, we want to take a look at our threads, because this is a multi-threaded quick sort. Let's take a look at some of these sorter threads. This thread, you can tell from the double dashes, has not been created yet. And so at time 104, we haven't built it yet. When I click on it, of course, we will go to the time when it was created, time 208. And here is one call to sort, or one recursive call to sort. And what it's going to do, of course, is going to sort, call average. It's going to make a new thread, a new sorter thread, to do half the work. And then it is going to recursively do the rest of the work. So there we are, sort from 0 to 10. Internally, we're going to sort from 6 to 10, while that guy goes from 0 to 5. Exactly the classic tech. No surprises here. Let me run through sort, and we're done. Makes sense? So if we take a look at where we are now, and we go to the end of this routine, and at time 695, we will see that, yes, it looks like we should be expecting these guys to be sorted 0 through 10. These guys are fairly sorted. So that's looking hopeful, at least. Let's take a look at a few more things and then go back and look at bugs. This fine little program here doesn't do much of great interest. Oh, let's take a look at a couple other sorted threads. There they are. They're just calling quick sort, and they all look absolutely identical, except that some are bigger and smaller. A little bit later in the program, we're going to do some printing out of stuff. As a matter of fact, we are going to print out our entire array. But more interesting at the moment is we are going to use... More interesting at the moment is we are going to take a vector and a hash table, and we're going to put things into them. I'd like to take a look at what it looks like when we do that. So let's close you down, and let's take a look at our vector and hash table. We have a vector, my vector over here, and a hash table, my hash table. And what we see at the moment is my vector has one item in it. Item 0 is 0 bottles of beer. And these, of course, are empty. The hash table, I happen to know the hashes are going to be these because I keep those aside. But currently, they have no values in them. And as we fill them up, then the what you expect to happen will happen. So let's take a look at the vector. I believe we're filling this guy up first. And we're going to be adding bottles of beer on the wall. And so we're just filling up the hash table. Nothing special. Hash table put, et cetera. Hash table and the vector. These are not how they're actually represented in memory, of course. So I do specialized displays so that they will be more understandable. Because it's a lot easier for me to say, oh, a string 0th is the key to 0 peers. That's a lot easier to read than to take a look at a full hash table object and work your way through it. So it's possible to do alternate displays of information, and this is a good thing to claim. And you can turn those off if you want to. You can look at the whole thing, but you never want to. So those are those guys. I believe that at the end of the program, we had a very sad and melancholy event occur. And yes, indeed, we threw a null pointer exception. I wonder where that null pointer exception came from. Let's go find out. Well, let's see. This line got printed right there. There I can see it. System out demo hot exception. So there's the exception. Let me move
this down because we want to take a look at. Here is where we were. We were in a routine, the print routine, and looked like we were printing things out when we got to our null pointer exception. And indeed, we can even see it says null dot equals. So that's a good sign that we're in trouble. So here we are at the code. We just caught it. If we step back one event, we will get to, of course, precisely that line, and voila, no surprise, you get a null pointer exception out of that. And now, why is that thing null? I don't know. Let's see, s dot equals, oh, s is null. Oh, that's is consistent. Why was s null? Well, let's see. We can ask good questions like, I just forgot my keystrokes. I want select local value. Ah, that's what I wanted. Here are all the values that s ever had. So it was first Albert, it got changed to Joshua, and then it became null. Oh. Let's actually pop up there and see what it looked like when it was Albert. So right up here, let's see. Ah, it looks like string s gets, oh, the element at I, which is Albert. Cool, that's pretty obvious. String s should be Albert. If we step forward, we will see that, let's see. It's Albert, continue. Cool, well, we can continue. And we'll go back up to the top of the list, and we will do the whole thing again. And this time, it looks like out of the list, we're going to get good old Joshua. Cool. So it looks like we're about to see this change to Joshua. And indeed, the value of S is now Joshua, just like we expected. And finally, let's go forward again and see where we get the next value. And the next value in the array is null. Well, that's where the null came from. So, why is there a null in there?
That's a good question. When you do a DALL, of course, values depend on it. You've got any way of looking and seeing that, which thread it is time or time, just so you can at a glance see so what time.
Interesting question. The answer is, I looked at that, and I decided that it wasn't worth doing. It just wasn't interesting enough at the time.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. You've got more interest.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've got more.
So anyway, so the answer is no, but you can certainly go through them and find them all. Let's take a look at this guy. We were looking, vector V. Let's go look at that vector. Let me close this guy. And this guy, let's open up my vector here. And okay, well, Albert, Joshua, and null. Ooh, and Ivan, good old Ivan. So we can go backwards in time and say, who set this to null? And we jump to a completely different location in the program where we are creating this guy in the first place, and we added some string s to here, and this string s turned out to be null, and the string s got its value from dt.name, and good old dt, well, here is a demo thing, fine. So dt had the value 2, the random number generator, and a name of null. Well, I wonder how it got to be null. Let's go take a look at all of the values ever had. Select instance variable value. Ah, so all the values name ever had were null, presumably on the constructor, Vladimir, and null again. And it was Vladimir. There we go. Okay, that looks like we're here. What did we just do a new random thing? And we had just created a name, get names of I. Okay, great. Names must be a vector of something, an array, which had a bunch of names in it. Look at that. And so there are a bunch of names in there. Those are all good names, fine and dandy. And so why did this guy, let's see which one of our strings become null. This guy, let's see what happens as we go forward in time. Here we are with Vladimir, and is that what I was looking at? Oh, I'm looking this guy. Well, he had been Vladimir, and he got changed to null. He got changed to null on this line right here, where it says dt.name gets null. So why did we write that line? That's a different question. But the point is, this is how we can go back and look at what's happening. This is one standard, this is a standard snake in the grass kind of bug, because I saw the tail, no pointer exception, and I just went straight backwards looking at the things that we wanted to look at. However, if you were looking carefully while I was talking, you probably noticed that you may have noticed that when we sorted our nice little array in quicksort, that it works perfectly all the way from 19 down to 1. And
what's 1 to 3 in France?
You know, that's
19 out of 20, that's 95%. That's an A in America. We give A's for 95%. So what in the world didn't happen here? Obviously the right thing didn't happen. And this is a slightly different type of problem. This is a type of problem where it is reasonable to take a look at a broad search over the data space as opposed to trying to work our way backwards from this value. Because we're not asking why did this value change, we're asking why did this value not change. So right down here where you cannot possibly see it, and it's doubtful, I'm not sure you can see it yet, but it says look for a port, you call the function where the first argument is equal to zero. So that's what I'm going to look for, because I'm expecting there to be a call to sort, which is supposed to sort element zero. So that is what I'm going to look for, and I'm going to start at the beginning of time, at the very first event, and then I am going to repeat that search. Search. And now we go forwards in time, and we find the first call to any method which has a first argument of zero. Ah, here we are. This guy obviously should have sorted element zero. He failed. And now what we'd like to do is we'd like to go through recursively and take a look at which call to sort was the one, the final one that should have done the work. So obviously, this guy is going to give 0 through 10 to a different thread. So we can continue to do this search right here going forward. And up there's a call to average. And going forward again, there is another call to sort, 0 through 10. And of course, we're going to see it go to the next thread and the next thread. Let's go straight to, I think we want to go to thread 4. We're sorting 0 through 5. And thread, looks like thread 7 is going to sort 0 through 2. And that guy didn't do a very good job of sorting elements 0 through 2. And of course, because he is a leaf node, we can simply go right into him and step through. So let's go take a look at, there we are in the sort routine. And as we go step through the sort routine, we will be able to figure out, presumably, why 0 didn't get sorted correctly. So calculate the average, we set up our new end, and we go into the pivot, or we go into the final test routine. Is this large enough to run a pivot on? The answer, I believe, is going to be no. So we're going to set up our ends, and actually, I'm lost. We are in the pivot routine, excuse me, and we failed to pivot where we wanted to, and the reason is, let's see, we should have gone 0 through 2, and what did we actually do? Started at J. J is going to start at 2, so we're supposed to be going in opposite directions. That all sounds fine and dandy, and we set our new end to J right where it should be. And when we come back to the starting routine, oh, I'm having a really hard time reading this, so I'm going to skip it for the moment, because I have lost my location in here. Instead, I'd like to move over here and take a look at something else. We have one question on future recomputations. Let's see if we can do one of those. We want to switch timelines. That seems like a good idea. So we have two possible timelines in the debugger. There's a real one, which we just ran. And now what we're going to be able to do is we're going to be able to move anywhere within our real timeline, choose a time, change any values that we want to, and continue or redo the computation from that point, more or less. So let's take a look at some point in here that we would like to be at. And let's take our array at some point in time when it is not well sorted. And I lost no more values. Which way am I in? Let's see, here we go. Let's move backwards in time a few times where we're much less sorted. Oh, okay, that looks fairly unsorted. That should be easier to take a look at. Let's go back a little bit more. No. Got a reasonably unsorted list. Yeah, no, that's vaguely unsorted. What I'd like to do is run the new expression. I want to evaluate the expression, and this is going to be a little bit difficult to read, I suspect. At the very bottom, I'm just about to type in a call to the method sort. So demo 0 dot sort of 0 through 6. Let's see what numbers did we have up there. Let's go 12 through 19 for the nice numbers. And so what's going to happen is we're going to rerun the run a new computation is what we're actually doing in a separate timeline. And as we do this, we take all of the values that used to exist here and revert them, and then we're going to go actually and run the sort routine. So we should see a point of confusion. Can I do this? Okay, it doesn't like me. I would like to take a look at a couple of the other things that we have on this. On a thread, if you represent a thread over here, if the thread ever blocks on anything, you get to know it. So you can come down here and you can say, ah, yes. Did this thread ever block? Yes, once upon a time. Once upon a time, the thread called hanger 10, that's the guy over there, was blocked waiting for demo thing, whatever that is. So there we see this guy is locked waiting for demo thing to release a lock. And counterwise, if we have anything that has a lock on it, we will see a set of pseudo variables. Who is waiting for the lock? Who is sleeping up, and who is the owner of the lock if the lock is indeed owned? So at one point in time, we see that this was owned by the thread hanger 10. Go forward, please. And so this typical object is mutex was owned by thread number 10, hanger number 10, which is this thread over here. So that we get to see who owns the locks, when they're released, and for that matter, how many threads are sleeping and waiting for things to happen. So you get to see all that information here. I would like to go now to the front of... Wait a second. Oh, well. Looks like... Oh, dear. There's a bug in the debugger. What do you do when you're giving a demo and there's a bug into your debugger? What?
Debug the debugger.
Oh, I should use the debugger to debug the... Of course, why didn't I think of that? We want the debugger debugger, yes! So what you have seen so far this evening is 35,000 lines of finely tuned Java code, all of which is fully instrumented. We are running the debugger under the debugger. So let's go debug the debugger with the debugger debugger. So what we're going to do is we're going to come over here to our fine debugger. Let's get you over here, please. Here is the control panel for the debugger, which is not what I want. I want the control panel for the debugger debugger. And I'm going to say start recording. I'm going to come over to the debugger. I'm going to push the button again. It will throw the exception again. I'm going to let this guy go away because now I want to look at the debugger debugger. And here we are in the debugger debugger. We have a line of output, exception and debugger command. Let's look at where that happened. You'll notice there are the threads that we expected to see. And when we move forward to the time when this is printed out, we will be in the event queue thread. Gee Willikers, no surprise, I pushed a mouse button and it got received by the event queue thread, as expected. So in the event queue thread, we printed out exception in debugger. There we go, exception in debugger command. Now we can go backwards and say, okay, where did that exception come from? Well, it looks like, and I'm going to step backwards here, it looks to me like we caught an exception. The exception came from, so here we are catching the exception, and we were in the method revert. So here we are in a standard looking set of method traces, and here is, of course, the jump out to the exception. So here is the unusual situation. We jumped way out to the exception. So why did something go wrong right about here? We called timestamp empty and returned false. That seems reasonable. The very next line in here caused a null pointer. And let's see, the very next line in here is ts.time. But what is ts? Well, gee Willikers, TS is null. So, why is TS null? Let us go backwards in time and see where this guy came from.
If we simply step backwards in the code frame,
it will go up to this line, return index equals 0, reasonable call for empty, and of course it is going to return false.
And that seems perfectly reasonable. I'm lost. What were I looking for? We're looking for TS. And TS came from, he was in our original call. So
the guy who originally called me passed me a TS of 0,
which is right up here.
So he passed me a TS of null. Yes, that is where the problem came from. There's the call to null. You step back in this guy, and I'm expecting we're going to go back up here.
No surprise.
And there we are. We're up here, passing the value of null. Why is this guy null? We don't want him to be null. And he got called. So TS is whatever this function returned.
What did that function return? Let's step back into that function. And
he returned, he returned null, which is probably not what we wanted this function to return. We can go back and look at the logic. Why did we return null? But at this point, the main idea is that, gee willikers, if he's returning null, whoever calls this guy better be expecting a null value. And so that's where the bug is that we were seeing.
So that is the fundamental operation of the omniscient debugger. Once again, this is to promote the idea that this is an interesting, cool thing to do. So what do you guys think? Any questions? Please.
Yes, very cool. How long has the idea been around? Yeah.
Well, Jules Verne wrote this story back in about 1840, but the earliest recording paper that I saw was from a gentleman by the name of Mike Model at Stanford Research Institute, where I was, in 1963.
So, why don't we do this in Microsoft?
What?
Why can't we do this right now in Microsoft Studio Code? It's a very good idea, and it worked really well, but why can't we?
Good question.
TotalView, which is an incredibly expensive debugger, I think is somewhere in the region of $1,500 license, has now got, and has for about 2 years got, that was my debugging and seeing Ultra. That's a lot of money. This isn't a lot of money.
Alright, this is a GNU license software, so it's totally free. And nobody can sue you for using the idea. It is public domain. So, anyway, actually, I did talk to Microsoft. I interviewed there for a few years ago, and they were interested, but didn't go anywhere. I also talked to Sun and Rational and IBM, and talked to Sun and Rational. So you want to know something about performance, is it? Mm-hmm. This is the first time anyone has ever asked me this question. All day.
All day.
Here is performance. Point number one, I'm trying to prove an idea, I'm not trying to do performance, therefore it doesn't count. Good answer?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Answer number two, there are bugs which are not amenable to this technique. I have never seen one because I've always been able to cut the bug down small enough so that it fits. This is a naive implementation which does not optimize, so it can get faster, but that does not change point number two. And answer number three, which is probably what you were looking for, is in a 31-bit address space, I have recorded 100 million events at a rate of about 1 microsecond per event, caveat, caveat, caveat. If you had a 64-bit address space, you could record for a very, very long time. And so how long are you willing to wait to debug your program? And now to some real specific data. Worst case scenarios. If you run entirely in iCache and you are running at the full clock speed every single cycle you are hitting something, then you will see a slowdown of up 300 times. The moment that you go out of pure iCache, look at this. That's all the loop is doing. If you do a microscopic amount of computation in there, it drops by a factor of 3. If you have a bigger array that goes outside of iCache, and of course you're spending a significant amount of time waiting for cache, which is what real computer programs do 95% of the time, then you get a vast comparative improvement. And because there are a lot of things that you don't need to record, I am not going to record the interiors of the string concatenation function. So all I record is that you called string concatenation and you got the value that you expected. And so because I'm not doing all that computation, once again, the overhead drops significantly. The ODB backend is a worst case scenario. The display is a not so bad scenario. Ant debugging, this is Ant recompiling itself. He ran at about a 7x slowdown. And those are typical types of numbers. There are things that you can do to reduce this. You saw me use a start-stop button. So if you know something related to some event, you can do that. You can do it automatically by saying, when you get to line number 73 and the value of x is 10, stop, start recording, stop recording. Actually any garbage. I simply throw away older events and hope that we didn't need them. So it's possible. It actually is not very effective. It was interesting to do, but it wasn't really worth it. I didn't like that. And more interesting, you can not record things that are either uninteresting or recomputable. So there are lots of optimizations you can throw in there. And so we should be able to get down to...
Could you actually specify, you know, a fully debug method object? Could you actually declare that that's the main I want you to address?
Yes.
I'm confident. That would cut down to the hell.
But yes, it does.
But equally, if you were convinced that the bug was inside Java, could you say, actually, I want it? In Java about 5 years ago, and eventually some fixed it.
Cool. The answer to that question is yes, but it's complicated. Because, of course, I'm using the Windows system myself.
Right.
So if I'm going to be debugging the Windows system, well, you're debugging what you're using. So what I have to do is I actually take the entire Windows system package, rename it with a different package name, and then I run my work in the original Windows system. I run the target program with the copy of the Windows system, and that way I can actually debug Swing or AWT. And indeed, have successfully found bugs that way. Anyway, so performance, it all goes back to answer number two. There are always bugs that won't be amenable to this technique, but if your bug is amenable to this technique, that's all you care about. Other questions? Yeah?
You got a nice Java demo there, but have you got uses in C++? Is there a library available to use?
So this is strictly works on a Java virtual machine. So anything that compiles down to Java bytecodes. No. There are several groups that have done little bits of work in a somewhat related area. So there is a group in Italy doing Leonardo, which is for C. There is another group that did something similar for Pascal. I don't actually know anyone who's ever tried to do C++. It's a lot. C++ is a complicated language.
So maybe C-sharp is awesome.
Yes. Now C-sharp would be... Yes, absolutely amenable to this. It's virtually the same style of code that you're using and the same set of things you're doing. Yeah.
You said that thing that's running along the graph actually. So without modifying it, like you use RC.
So you don't, it's harder to do because you're going through intermediate codes, but it I have done it does work. But if I were to actually put my effort into Jython, I would do a number of other types of, what I want to call that, user interface refinements that will show you the code the way you expect it to be, as opposed to the way it quote-unquote really is. Just like I did with hash tables and with other things.
You wouldn't be able to debug a Python source.
You can do that. It takes a little bit of indirection, but it is possible. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
let's
say there is a bug with this doesn't represent the cost of the array of like,
no, it's
the
because
talk in the room, you said it's like all I think there might be situations, especially when you switch to red screen, you have a bug and run the string at the instrumentation by the debugger, you pause the synchronization, pause the recording in the log, and something doesn't show up, and then what you try.
Yes, and that is one example of there are bugs which will not appear under this debugger. At which point you just say, I can't do that. So the classic, and I believe you were referring to, the weak memory model. Would never occur under this debugger because we force the locking. And because of that, we force the cache flushes out of weak memory machines.
Question about optimization points. So, if you wanted optimizers, what do you think would be a good path to look at? Multi-core, multi-processor, distributed people using a GPU.
Mm-hmm.
What do you reckon would be a good way of thinking about how you improve the performance?
Well, the number one issue that I would look at is not the performance, it's the use. In other words, it runs fast enough right now that we can spend a really good, useful time in saying, how can we use this technology best, and what is the most effective way to put it to application, and we don't really need to speed it up because we have enough on our plate over here. Nonetheless, people like to talk about optimizations. So the types of things, like you said, were perfectly reasonable anywhere that you can. And this is part of the other question, which was, in all of those times where I've had a huge, huge mass of data that I'm pouring through a pipeline or something, I've always been able to locate the bug within some relatively small section of that. So I haven't had to run the giant, giant super pipeline. But like I said, there are bugs that are that kind of bugs, and it wouldn't work very well.
If you wanted to do it in more performance, so you've got something to test, but you put it on a server that's got a faster processor, it's got more processors, or has got many, many cores, what hardware are you throwing?
This particular implementation, and remember, this is just my implementation, it's going to get thrown away. If anybody really gets inspired and gives me gobs of money and say, Bill, go do this for us, then it'll be a complete new code base. We'll do things differently. But with the single lock technique, which we have here, and then it's best on a single fast machine, a single CPU. Multiple CPUs will actually slow it down. Yeah.
Because you're never going to be able to serialize it.
Right.
Without that, that's mm-hmm. the key.
Yep. Yeah.
Use cases that I'm not personally ever doing code, but something that I find very confused to use is I need people to engineer it to somebody else. It's taking the same push that the value of this variable, which might have been actually a key program to the point that it's up on everywhere, might have been completely different places with no idea that it's helpful, but if you have an application device for
well, we can basically store data forever. So the only question is, how long do you want to wait? If it takes 4 minutes, your bug to manifest itself, are you willing to wait 40 minutes to run the debugger? And so that's the only question here. Up, of course, and getting out things to disk effectively, et cetera, but fundamentally, you can record anything.
So when you say you don't run out, so say if you're saying we don't run out of referencing, but surely we could do run out of memory or all the map space.
As long as you're in a 64-bit address space, you've got a lot of time on your hands before you get to 64 bits. So yeah, we can store data forever. That really isn't the issue. And a number of the people that I've worked with have actually done it. An issue at all.
What I mean is, say you're running a machine where you've got 32 bytes of memory and you're actually processing 40 bytes left, then is there any way that we can put to say that so we found our bug here? But I guess I'm trying to explain the question. Because you've only got eight lots of 40 bytes.
Right. But let's say that you can store data for a year. Perfectly reasonable number. So that's already beyond anything. I would not wait for a year for a program. So, does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying?
No, what I mean isn't how long you store that data for, but just how much data you can store. Obviously, eventually you run out of space for it then.
Right, but just get a few 100 gigabyte disks and that'll last you a long time.
And your point is that it's unproductive. You attempted that in our last program to try and cut the problem.
And it's always better to try and cut it down. There are all sorts of other, a lot of issues arise somewhere around 10, 20 million events in my using of it. And my opinion is that most bugs actually can be located very quickly down to a very short time period. That's been my experience. It's obviously not always true. And then, like I said, at the end of the day, there are bugs to which this technique is non-amenable. And you try it. If it works, cool, you're happy. And if it doesn't work, then you go back to a different technique.
What sort of bugs can't be
on? Well, anywhere, which of course is kind of what we were talking about, where it's hard, where you have no idea to put a bound on where the bug is likely to occur or the primary manifestation, because as when the bug happens after you push a button, it's real easy, you know. You set up the program, you start recording, you push the button, and start looking. But when you run a server program for 6 hours and something goes wrong after 6 hours, you know, are you going to record 6 hours? Most of the time, you have a real good idea.
Is it good for finding race conditions?
Oh, yeah. And,
well, you don't know how long you're going to leave again before you get that race condition.
Well, it is non-deterministic after all. But as you know, as long as it shows up in a reasonable amount of time, then boom, you've got it. And it can't get away from you. Yeah.
The scenario you described, say, I push a button and that goes wrong. So is that I'm recording before I flash your memory implementation is showing us what does it do when I start recording? Does the whole thing of everything go to disk and that, or just the core that changes somewhere that doesn't have much out?
Just the changes. So, and once again, now we're talking about implementation techniques, and there are all sorts of possible optimizations, and I used all sorts of ways to cheat and get around little corners. And I can save 8 bytes by doing this little thing over here, and that's interesting, but it's optimization, and it's actually not what I'm really interested in. What I'm really interested in is this useful? How do we use it more effectively? So those are the real questions that I'm asking. So that's why I'm talking all about navigation, how to go backwards in time, how to select the variables, how to step up to the previous function calls, etc. That's where I think the really interesting parts here are. Notably, most of the people who have worked in this area or related have focused all of their efforts on optimization. So virtually all of the papers you read will talk about how to make things faster, and they never talk about how to actually use it. And so, there it is. Yes. If you Google the word omniscient, you will find that over the past few years, it has generally been a battle for first place between me and God. So, Google the word, you'll get to it, the full distribution is there. You, at that point, you have everything that I have. And like I said, it's a GNU license, so take the source, do whatever you want with it, and have fun. Yeah,
you're back. It would be you could put minus gone, and then you get only yours.
Yeah. But you're happy to have people, if people actually want to take the open source and do some work on it.
For sure.
That you have it, you're open to that.
Absolutely. I have had several different groups approach me for precisely this, and I give them some good advice, and most of my advice is, what is most of my advice is, nah, just rewrite it. It'll be easier for you. But there are portions that you can reuse my stuff in. Some of it is just, yeah. Yeah.
So, I've got your website here. It says 2007. So is there stuff in the last 4 years, top secret?
So, no, I have not been working on it. The past 4 years I've been doing bioinformatics. I've been using it while I'm doing the bioinformatics, but I haven't been working on it. So I can tell you a great deal about all the bacteria that inhabit your lower intestine. If you ever want to know, I've got it.
You didn't want to know about thyroid, did you?
Yeah.
Because I have a friend who worked for us doing exactly that. He's been made redundant. He and Casper have all been made redundant.
Wow.
Bioinformatics, protein folding.
That is a very popular thing to be doing right now.
Yeah.
But it's all by my program. Okay, and any other questions, thoughts, discussions, arguments?
Is there any way of connecting it to another information on
I looked at doing it in Eclipse. Do you know how difficult it is to write Eclipse plugins?
I don't.
In any case, yes, it could be done. I am not inspired to try to do it.
If anybody else wants to do it?
I will give them all my help. My usual programming technique is I use Eclipse and I simply fire off the debugger from Eclipse. And I have the interface that works fine, and you don't really need any particular connection between Eclipse and your debugger. Because what you do is you go through, you find your bug, and you say, oh, that's where it is. and then just go to Eclipse and fix the source code. So it hasn't been an issue. Like a couple of the other things that we talked about where they just weren't issues. I built these things, I tried them out, they worked, and then I find that I didn't want them. I never used them. So, okay.
Okay. Well, what I will say is that this talk was suggested by one of our members who actually spotted your work here tonight. So with thanks to him for giving us the lead, thanks to Bill for coming over from Cambridge, Massachusetts. So this, can we just take a show of hands? It's sort of like an idea whose time has come. Who would vote for it?
Yeah.
I think you can take that feedback.
I will take that as positive feedback.
Right.
Wait. While I'm here, I get a picture of all of you?
Sure.
All right. 1, 2, 3, smile. Now I can prove to them that I was actually here.
Then I'm going to get one more of you. Okay? That's great. And you're actually standing still this time.
I rarely do that.
Thanks very much for that.